You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden, and this week we're talking love. But wait, we're not talking the soppy, romantic, fairy tale love, because that's not how the real world works, is it? Real love takes work, commitment, and recognizing your flaws, as All the Best producer Miriam Elfberg found out during this story.
Doing really peculiar things like washing for hours, counting, checking, cleaning, and my thought was always if I didn't do everything perfectly, somebody in my family would die. And
now the final frame. So you can get to this sort of situation where, you know, intimacy only happens on, you know, Tuesday night, after dinner, after I've, you know, sat around for a couple of hours and had a drink.
1 million Australians have the anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder. It can control their behaviour to the point where their life is dominated by strict routines. But it also affects the people around them. What happens when a person with OCD falls in love?
Look, there's probably not a person who doesn't go to work sometime in their life and go, "Did I turn off the iron? Did I close the front door?" The difference is those people just get back on with work and forget about it. Someone with OCD will go back and do it and check it, make sure that it is off, all the doors locked.
This is Juliet Leach.
I think it's like being an alcoholic. You might never drink for 30 years, but it's still an alcoholic, because I truly believe that if I thought I'll just check the stove and I'll just check the car today, tomorrow it'll be the car, the stove, the front door, next day. And, you know, within 2 weeks it would be all back. I truly believe that.
Psychologist Emily Scanlan explains what OCD is.
So if you want to look at a useful definition of OCD, it's kind of like having a sticky mind. You know, I have thoughts and I get stuck in certain types of thoughts and I can't put them down. But it manifests in a different way for everybody. So it's not a specific set of symptoms. Like, you might have one person who's washing their hands a lot, or you might have somebody else who just really needs to stick to a routine day in and day out. And so, you know, if you were the second person and you were falling in love, your anxiety is already there. It's going to go up higher, because how are you going to accommodate that person in your routine? You know, and the routine is a sense of being in control. And most people who experience OCD feel that their anxiety comes down by being more in control of their lives.
Myself, when I met my husband-to-be, he just thought I had quirky ways. Once we got married, then my OCD just went, you know, exploded, because whilst I was at home, my mum did most of the stuff. She locked up, she did all those sorts of things. Once I got married, I had to look after him and I had to look after the house. So my rituals just became full-blown. Now, he just thought I had quirky ways. He thought that was the way I locked the door, that was the way I did. It was once I started to get him involved over time that he started to put his foot down, because I would make him get up 3 and 4 times a night to check the windows and doors. You know, I had to boil everything before I cooked and use them. So there were lots of things, but we still didn't know what the problem was. Now, as good and all as he was before treatment and during treatment and after treatment, he still would say sometimes, "I don't know why you just couldn't stop washing your hands, or why you couldn't just stop checking." Now, that proves to me that he really didn't. And I can understand it, because I didn't understand it and I had it, but he didn't understand really what I was going through. But he was supportive, very supportive, and still is. It was very tiring for him, watching me. It certainly stopped our social life, because I couldn't get ready and get out the door on time. I think it also impacted on his friendships, because I was wanting to keep him safe all the time. If he wanted to go to golf with the boys, I'd tag along too, because I thought if I was with him, I could save him. Now, I don't know what from. If he went to squash, the same thing. So they started falling away. They stopped inviting him to play golf. They stopped inviting him to play squash. So that had a huge impact on him. Not that he ever complained, and I couldn't see it at the time, but now I can sit back and look at it. I think that was a terrible thing to do. But the thing for him that really triggered it, I used to wake him up 3 or 4 times a night to check windows and doors, and if he'd say, I'll check them, I'd say, if you love me, you'll check them again. Emotional blackmail. The thing that really triggered him off was one night I said, we have to sleep with the light on. He said, why? And I said, I don't know, it'll just keep people safe. Because remember, I didn't know what I had. And that's when he said, you have to see the doctor because I can't live like this anymore. We went to the GP, I told him about the checking, the washing, the cleaning, the counting, the thoughts, if I didn't do it, somebody would die. And he said, I don't know what it is, but you need to see a psychiatrist. And then at 30, after seeing a psychiatrist for 2 years every week, who never diagnosed OCD, even though I told her about all those things, my husband read about it in a women's magazine at work, would you believe, just flicking through it at lunchtime in the lunchroom. And from there we found out what it was, got help, and, you know, I've had 24 years of having it under control.
Obsessing over things and getting stuck in things is very, very common. And if it's going on for you or your partner, there is something that you can do about it. There are lots of strategies for dropping unhelpful thoughts. And better that you come in and see someone and talk about how to get out of this feeling stuck than you notice that relationship after relationship drops away because the person complains that you're being too controlling.
I live my life like I don't have OCD, but because I might get the thought, you know, once or twice a year, although they don't scare me anymore and they don't send me into rituals, I think it's like being an alcoholic. You might never drink for 30 years, but it's still an alcoholic, because I truly believe that if I thought I'll just check the stove and I'll just check the car today, tomorrow it'll be the car, the stove, the front door, next day, and, you know, within 2 weeks it would be all back. I truly believe that.
A person often has a desire to control not just their routine but also others sometimes. And if anyone wants to join in their life, then it's like, well, that's fine, but this is my routine, you know. And so that can be a real battle in relationships in terms of whether the other person wants to take on some of that and how much the person with the routine is willing to be flexible with it. So you can get to this sort of situation where, you know, intimacy only happens on, you know, Tuesday night, after dinner, after I've, you know, sat around for a couple of hours and had a drink, you know, and it can get very, very rigid, and the other person can start to feel a bit like the marrow is being sucked out of things. And so getting the person who's experiencing the rigidity, who feels they need the rigidity, to notice that if they give it up, nothing bad happens, and in fact their life improves, can be quite a long process.
I think the most important thing above everything is to get treatment. Because once you've got treatment, all those sorts of things will disappear. I've known people, I've run support groups for 24 years, so I've known people who have never told their partners that they have OCD. Their partners must wonder what they do. I have other people who tell them and they may leave the relationship because they can't handle it.
If they came to that point in their mind where it was like, you know what, this person is worth it, then they will be willing to loosen up the routine, which is, of course, very good for them. So, in fact, falling in love with someone with OCD, it can be, you know, the best kind of therapy.
If you love the person, get treatment, have them involved, let them talk to the doctor too, find out what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing to help you, and talk about it, because it's an illness like any other sort of illness. But if you can get on top of it, then you can have your life back and you can live life like you don't have OCD.
And there are really great psychological strategies for noticing when you're getting stuck, when you have that sticky feeling, and actually going, you know what, this kind of thinking isn't helpful for me, and I'm going to put it down and be open to doing something different here. And that takes courage, but it's also a tool that you've got to be willing to try. And love is a great reason to try it.
The treatment is very tough and it's scary, but it's certainly worth it. In the long run, it's better to get your life back.
That story was produced by Miriam Elfberg. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden, and today we're looking at complicated love. But as Zoe Ferguson found out talking to her friend Maddie, even the most complicated love story can start out with something simple, like a cup of tea.
I remember the leading up to it for a really long time, and I don't think I really understood the whole idea of what was actually happening. I kept putting in the back of my mind that it couldn't have been what it actually was. This sort of thing just happens to people in stories. I don't know, it never happens personally to you. You just got to sort of hear about it through other people. She was getting tests done and that it was going to still be like a while till we found out what it actually was. Mum and Maddie came home and Mum kind of just looked at me and just shook her head, and then Maddie was, she came through the door and she was acting all stoic and stuff as she always does. She just looked at me and then just started crying. It was then that I was just like, shit, there's actually something properly wrong and it's not just going to be put into the back of your head.
Hi, my name is Maddie Costa and I'm 23 years old. It had been diagnosed as whooping cough, it had been diagnosed as asthma, as allergies, as a post-nasal drip and hypochondria. So we went to go get an x-ray done. At the end of it, they said, oh yeah, we think we can see what's causing your cough. We want to run a CT scan, which I didn't know any better, so I assumed that that's really good. That's not really good. And then I was supposed to be getting blood tests done the next day, and then my mum called me up and said, don't worry about going to the doctors for the blood test, just come home. And then I came home and my mum was sitting on the couch and she was like, all right, well, come and sit down with me. And she was like, all right, so I spoke to the doctors at work and I got the results for your CT. I got the results and she just kept repeating it, and I was like, can you just tell me what the hell it was? Because I could see that she started crying. And then she told me that they'd found a large mass in my chest. We're going to have to get a biopsy. And they didn't know what was causing it, but obviously the first thing that you think is that it's going to be cancer. That was when I think I actually really started freaking out a bit. I went to the specialist and we were sitting in there and he basically put the images up and he had a look at them, and in all of 5 seconds he was like, okay, it's a malignant mass. I'd probably say it's lymphoma. It might be Hodgkin's or it might be, you know, something else, but it's definitely a malignant tumour. Basically, I shut down. I just needed to get the hell out of there. I was sitting there and I was crying uncontrollably. I got in the car and I basically flipped my biscuit, you know, just swearing my head off and crying, and just like, I never even smoked. I never did, you know, any of that stupid shit. And I was like, it's so unfair. I was in the car and I was saying, like, when we go home, I need to break something. Mom was like, absolutely. She's like, look, I'll find you some plates. You can smash some plates. So got home, I stood in the front of my house and I just smashed it to smithereens and I just burst out crying and just stood there. When I found out, I fell to pieces, but it was like emotionally but physically as well. It's like, because for such a long time I'd been so tired, I've been getting sweats during the day, these fevers where I just thought, you know, okay, I'm just a bit of a freak. I'd be sitting there, it'd be, you know, a 20 degree day and I'd be like perspiring like mad. I was so exhausted. I was having 4 or 5 coffees a day. I was so tired all the time. I would be sleeping you know, 9-10 hours a night usually, and I would wake up and I would be so, so tired, and I brushed all of it off. At that point, I was wearing size eight clothes, and they were baggy on me. Basically, I'd had heaps of stuff that was kind of falling off me, and I had huge bags under my eyes all the time. My eyes, like, I looked exhausted. By the point just before we'd started treatment, I was sitting in a car, and it had actually started protruding from my chest. It had gotten to the point where the lump was actually extending out, and I had a seatbelt across me, and it was pushing on it, and it was hurting because it had gotten so big. I was thinking, well, if it's just such a big tumour, just cut it out and we'll move on. But it's the whole thing where it's you have these cells that are damaged and they reproduce so fast, and cutting it out doesn't get rid of it. You know, at a cellular level, you don't necessarily get rid of it. I had to get 6 months of chemotherapy and a fortnight of radiotherapy. Talking through the actual experience, you go into the hospital, you have a major, like a big comfy chair for the person who's getting chemotherapy, and then one for their companion. You sit in the chair, they access your port, which basically means they get a needle that is about an inch or an inch and a half long, and it is, you know, a couple of millimetres thick, and they just punch it through. It's really weird. You can feel the chemicals making you feel sick at some points. You get aversions, and they talk about how you develop aversions to things, particular smells, particular foods, things like that, because then you have this really strong association with the chemotherapy and it makes you feel sick. So I actually can't have Lebanese food anymore. I think about it and I feel physically ill. My hair was a big identifier for me. I would always have, you know, different hair colours. That was how I asserted myself in a family where three girls look fairly similar. That was my thing that I did to, you know, to stand out. When you find out you're going to get chemo, and the first thing you think after, like, you know, oh shit, cancer is, you think, oh God, I'm going to lose my hair. To me, it was a constant reminder. So even if I was feeling okay, I would look in the mirror and, like, I would see that my hairline had receded so much, and I would feel sick looking at it. I was fortunate in that I didn't completely lose my hair. It knocks your confidence a lot, and it's this whole thing where I think for me particularly, it was I didn't want to be identified as cancer patient, and I didn't want to look like a cancer patient. There's a whole shift in your identity, and you stop being an independent individual. You stop being yourself, essentially. That's what it feels like. You don't have uni, you don't have any of your old self. Your mind is so fried from all the drugs that you can't read, you can't watch anything of substance, you can't hang out with people for more than a couple of hours without being exhausted, you know. So I think the whole thing with losing your hair is it's just, it compounds that, and it's kind of like, it's just another way in which you feel like yourself is being leached, and just, you're just becoming like another, you know, cancer patient. My recovery time period went from being, you know, a couple of days laid up, it was just like I would just lie down for a week, and it's just so physically exhausted. It's not the same as being tired when you're like, I haven't slept. It's like this tiredness is just in your bones. You can't do anything and you don't even want to because you just feel so shit. You just want to lie there. And it's just, I would have so many days where I would just lie in bed and do nothing. There's kind of always this overarching sense of guilt. You just kind of think, well, why am I still complaining so much? Because it could have been so much worse. And it's like, I remember hearing some story about this little girl that had chronic cancer, and she was in the USA. When she died, I was so upset because I was just like, why am I complaining so much when I've got it so much better than her? And you're like, I'm not healthy, but I'm also not sick enough to allow myself to not feel bad about it, if that makes sense. You do have to face your mortality, and it's, oh, at fucking 22. And you sit there and you're like, all right, well, the reality is that, you know, I might not, like, survive this.
It is really important to, you know, identify that that could be one of the possible outcomes of this. I'm Ali, and I'm Maddie's younger sister. I'd consider myself pretty cynical and a pessimist as is. The entire time when I was around her, you know, there were always the doubts that were floating in the back of your head about, am I going to lose my best friend? But I think I never let it actually come out, because if she saw me crying about it or something, then what's going to do to her? As the little sister, I had to kind of step up to be the big sister and make sure that she didn't think those thoughts. And so by association, I wasn't really, like, I wouldn't allow myself to think negatively like that. I remember just being really hostile when James came into the picture, as bad as that sounds, especially because it's such a big thing to deal with that. I think all of the family was pretty wary having a new guy in the picture. What if this doesn't work out? And then she has to deal with cancer as well as having a broken heart. As time went on and he kept sticking around, and like I'd come home from work and then he'd be there just like cuddling her. I think the fact that he was there throughout the whole thing, and that even just them finding love in just such a shit environment, I think it really brought hope. I don't think Maddie could have gone through it as well as she did without him by her side.
I think he made it a much less unpleasant experience than it could be. He was one of many people who made it a lot better than it could have been. It gave a real kind of element of normalization in what was otherwise a very ridiculous kind of year.
Remember, she said that at one point, that she just wanted to go on dates with a dude and just remind herself that there's more to her at the moment than just being a cancer patient.
Hi, my name's James O'Reilly. Going back quite a while, but we both kind of had a crush on each other in high school. I would always go over to her place. I'd always bring her tea. I understood that, you know, she was still getting chemotherapy when I started seeing her. When we were first going out, because she was quite sick, she couldn't go out much, and so she thought that she was boring. I still enjoyed hanging out with us. So I had to keep telling her and, you know, reassuring her that you're not boring.
He was so understanding with everything that it was just ridiculous. Like, it was just, he was fantastic when it came to anything. You know, if I was feeling sick, I remember when we first, like, it was one of the first times we were hanging out, I was feeling really self-conscious because I was really tired, and it was just like, I'm sorry, I'm so boring. And I was just working myself up. He's like, I don't care. I just want to be around you. I remember when we first started hanging out, he turned up and he got me this chocolate that I had mentioned that I loved. He had a canister of tea that he had pre-made in like a thermos because he knew I loved tea. So he brought me tea and coffee, depending on what I wanted.
Yeah, every now and again I'd bring other bits and pieces and treats and that, just to make her feel better.
I pretty much told Maddie not to listen to this artist called Keaton Henson until she was ready, because it's the saddest music that you'll ever hear, but it's just so beautiful. And I remember coming home one night and she's like, Ali, guess what? I'm like, what? And she's like, I listened to Keaton Henson last night and I didn't cry. And I'm like, I'm so proud of you.
I'd had some more tests done. I had this thing called a PET scan, which basically checks for active cells, and they had done one and I was waiting on hearing the results, and I remember just cracking up about it because it was just like, my mum and I had been arguing about something really dumb that day because she was doing some gardening in the backyard, and I came down and she looked at me, and then I was just like, I got a message, and so it says, you know, like, there's no active trace of Hodgkin's. And then we both just flipped out and we just started crying. You know, my dad's standing there, Mr. Big Stoic electrician, just tears rolling down his face. So that was pretty unreal. There's times when it hits you really hard, and then there's other times when you just don't even realise that last year happened. There's still a massive aftermath, which I think a lot of people, and myself included, I didn't know until now. Recovery takes as long as, if not longer than, your treatment, and there is, I think, this big tendency to think that once chemo's done, once radio's done, you're finished. And I'm still kind of trying to come to grips with taking care of myself better. And I get sick really easily. I have... my exhaustion levels are still pretty high. They're a lot better than they were, but it's things like having to know that you're going to have to deprive yourself of something, because ultimately you need to kind of take care of your health, because if you get sick, you're not going to get better for another 3 months, that sort of thing.
I think everyone looks at cancer as like a massive journey, especially because a lot of people aren't as fortunate as Matt, and you know, it does last for years and years. And the fact that we got through this in a year, obviously it's still with us massively, but the fact that she could say that she was in remission by Christmas, to do that in the year, she defied the odds, absolutely.
It's still got a massive sense of unreality about it.
That story was produced by Zoe Ferguson. This episode of All the Best was lovingly produced at Sin Radio in Melbourne in association with FBI Radio in Sydney and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to all the producers who contributed to this episode, Miriam Elfberg and Zoe Ferguson. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan. Our community coordinator is Pip Rasmussen. Our executive producer is Jordana Caputo. And I'm Michael Bryden. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
Is the way it would be. Did you know when you were already born? You were already you and I already me. So take me as I am. Get your pen.